Someone must have some burning question that somebody in the room could answer.
I mean, it's come up in conversation a few times, and a few of us have said that we would think about it, but has anybody actually figured out all the 21 centimeter physics and all the recouplings and decouplings and everything? Or?
I guess if someone can tell me why the spin temperature is the same as the baryon temperature when stars turn on, that'd be great.
Is it? I've heard claims that it was just lower the difference.
Yeah. No, I think that stars are supposed to recouple the spin temperature to the
baryon. I've heard that claim too.
They recouple them to the baryons, but it doesn't have to go all the way down to the adiabatically cooled baryon temperature. So that's the minimum that it can be.
Yeah, I don't understand either of these.
So I can attempt to draw what I understand more, just because.
I hope this isn't like some really like illicit use of time or something.
No, I think 21 centimeters is a perfectly illicit use of our time. Because the good news is, because this is a holiday, there's no recording of this discussion set.
Oh, right.
So that's the best day of all the days in the program to have a...
So this is smaller direction. Smaller z is that direction. So this is the photons. And they're going like 1 plus z at all times. And at first, until the scattering decouples, the baryons are tied to that, and then they start to adiabatically cool, like 1 plus z squared, and just smoothly, like overall, cosmologically, they're cooling like that. But some of these are falling into halos and making the very first stars around a similar redshift. So this is around z of 200 to 300, and the first stars have to
get. Is Thompson scattering the dominant thing there? Because most stuff's in neutral stuff.
So it's still Thompson's dominant.
The ionization fraction is high enough that dominates.
Yeah, the ionization fraction is going down, which is partially why it's turning off. Okay. But it's always photon. Electron that's
free electrons are the dominant thing.
So the very few free electrons are the things that are catalyzing the baryons to stay tied to the CMU.
Okay.
So then these go up and hit a hydrogen.
Okay.
And keep putting it up.
So what's the ionization fraction before the first stars turn on? Is it pretty low?
Yes, the ionization fraction.
Eventually it goes up, right, once the first stars turn on.
Yeah,
so
that's
around 14.
That's a
d
of 7 or something.
Yeah, so it kind of evolves like
starts
this.
Going up.
And at like 20, it's around a few times to the minus 4.
I see. And then it goes up to almost 1 later?
Inside of galaxies, it spikes, but...
but outside of galaxies, it's not.
I think it no longer becomes good to... A good approximation to ignore the nonlinear effects, but I think if you were, then it would just continue.
Okay, for this story, it's 10 to the minus 4.
For this story, it's 10 to the minus 4. Yeah, 10 to the minus 4, 2 to the minus 4, you can keep in mind. Okay, cool. So this is so Thompson scattering decouples around then, baryons decouple from the CMB, and then this spin temperature recouples to the starlight. This is the thing
recouple, or does it just never decouple?
I think it never decouples. It's just that the scattering is stronger in the first place, so it tracks baryons,
yeah.
And then the gas is rarefied, and then it goes back to...
I think that's what Sam was drawing.
Yes.
Yeah.
So first, there's the coupling between the spin temperature and the collisions in the gas.
Yeah.
So that keeps the spin temperature coupled to the baryons for a bit, but then the collisions between the gas go down, so that decouples, and then it goes back to the CMB temperature.
Yeah, so like, so bound, so now bound scattering decouples. That's what you'd say if you were an astrophysicist. This is free. This is bound.
But then it doesn't just continue its value. The collisions with the photons are enough to bring it back up to.
So then, CMB. Then it's at the CMB temperature.
So why is that So the collisions with the CMB aren't enough to keep the baryons in at that temperature. They are enough to push the spin temperature back up.
That is, yeah, so that's, so I guess in order to keep the baryons coupled, you would need...
But you need lots of collisions per minute.
So in order to keep the baryons coupled, you need to make sure... So in order to keep the baryon temperature...
It's absorption and emissions, right?
They're different processes, yeah. But
it's also a question of how many scatterings you need to have. So in order to calculate this, you need to calculate when the change in temperature divided by the temperature is the order bubble. That says is d by dt. So when the rate of change temperature is about the Hubble temperature. This is the second moment of the Tolson equation. But in order to get the spin flip recoupled, you don't need to hit it a bunch of times. You just need to hit it once. And so I think that it can still be in equilibrium past this. And there's also you're also not being hit by the ionization fraction and stuff. It's not totally obvious to me why this happens.
Okay, no, it makes sense for different.
But that's what I think. And then, and so then this is the spin temperature, and then it's supposed to come back down. I mean, it's just, I didn't draw this all to scale, but.
So, technically, in the dip that you just drew, there would also be an absorption line. We just don't see that.
There would, yes. Well, But what would it be observing? I mean, so there would be an absorption.
The spin temperature is lower than the CMB temperature, so effectively it's absorbing.
Yeah, it should be absorbing. That's what it's doing as it's going back up to the CMB temperature.
But the dip might be small enough.
Yeah, maybe the fractional dip is just too small.
Yeah, at that point, these temperatures aren't as different.
And it starts to go down just because it decouples from the CMB?
No.
Yeah. Well. So the question is, what's driving this physics? This is the thing that we were all trying to figure out. And so I think what's happening is spin. This is the 21 centimeter transition. Is the photon emitted as you flip spins? But if you are in the excited state and you absorb some UV radiation, then you can fall back down either of those and emit a line and off a photon. And so I think that you, the question is, how do you know, once you've emitted the line and off a photon, how do you reestablish the right ratio between spin up and spin down in the 1s state?
Yeah, I mean, technically, you can also absorb from the lower state.
Yeah,
it's not at all clear why this drives you to a colder temperature.
Right. Because it seems like it would make because the big split is much bigger than the small one.
Yeah.
So it seems like it would populate the 21 centimeter.
Equal.
So this transition.
Right.
So this is a long lived state. This is the Lyman alpha. Transition can happen more quickly, but yeah. Then the question is why? Yeah, how do you get the right ratio between these two?
So I read the words, but I'm not sure what it really means. But I read the words that this, so the Lyman alpha, this UV radiation that comes from first stars, it's actually exchanging energy with the medium because of Doppler shifts, and somehow this energy exchange makes this Lyman alpha radiation be thermalized with the baryons.
Yeah, I read those words too.
But the Lyman alpha is effectively a much higher temperature, so you expect that to raise the temperature?
I have troubles thinking in terms of temperatures.
Those temperatures are brightness temperatures, right?
They're
just higher numbers.
There's not a temperature here.
So the question is, what temperature should it go back to after, what's the expectation after you've decoupled it from here, what temperature should it be? What temperature should you be observing after this Wood-Heisenfeld effect has turned back on?
And so what do you call it?
Wood-Hazen field
effect? Oh, yeah.
Yes, and okay. that's this effect of the stars turning on and...
Oh, yeah, but just how do you spell it?
Wood-Hazen field effect is this, which decouples the... So the spin temperature is the ratio of particles in this, ratio of hydrogen atoms and spin up and spin down, and that's coupled to CMB because this period of time is longer than the lifetime of that state. So it's in equilibrium with the CMB for that period. And then the Wood-Hazen field effect decouples the spin temperature from the CMB temperature. Right, and so then the question is, it decouples it from the CMB temperature, but what temperature does it tracking on? And the answer is that you need to run a simulation, I think. And so this is the stuff that people have done. This is what Varkana and Anastasia Fialkov had done 1,000 times. And they had always found that it was doing something like this, where it was this is that the brightness temperature, basically. So the difference between the CMB temperature and the spin temperature is the thing that they're measuring. And so it's the answer is that in the standard astrophysical picture, you aren't getting all the way back down here.
Okay.
Because you are living now. Because
the stars turn on so quickly that you just start heating it up more.
So now there's more kinetic energy than you thought, so you're not really in this adiabatic regime anymore.
So just check, and the turning up at the end, is that purely thermal, like the gas is being heated up, or is some other effect?
The fact that this goes back about?
Yeah,
I think that's just because now you're deep inside of the non-linearity, and so now you're just...
The gas is heating up at that point.
Gas is heating up right in the fall, gravitational fall. No longer from just talking to CMB and stuff, everything is totally...
And also the stars, or just the is it not, it's dominated by the gravitational inequality?
Quite possibly stars as well, yeah. Because they're releasing 10 to 5 times more energy than, that's just... So they're doing a lot. So I think it's just a complicated question of what the temperature is. And the fact that they measure something like this, it really was unexpected. Like, they really were surprised to find that.
But if you're doing simulations to understand, putting in the fact that early stars are turning on and everything's very nonlinear, that's not at all obvious to me that what your error bar in the theory should be.
I think
in the original measurement paper, they're like, oh my god, this is definitely not standard model. But so you're saying that it's even lower than the temperature of the variance.
Yeah, exactly. That's the thing.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
But then
it's also not. I mean, it goes back to your question that you were saying before. Why does it go only to the variance temperature?
It couldn't be cold. So they run all their simulations and they find that they do kind of populate.
No, but I don't understand why, if there's some independent process that we don't understand, it's happening and then it's somehow repopulating the two spin levels. It's not clear to me that that's necessarily related to the baryon temperature. Maybe there is some parameter space where it gets colder than the baryons. Like, what process is stopping it from getting colder than the
I think this is a general discussion.
I don't mean to be up.
It's collisions, isn't it?
No, but at this point, the gas is super dilute. Collisions don't do anything.
But I think that's the point, is that you're no longer, on average, you can't ignore the overdensities now.
Okay.
So there's some parts of the universe now which you'd expect to be half and half and spin up and spin down, like half and 1s.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some parts where you'd expect that there'd be no kinetic energy and they could all be in some sense spin down. So I think that's part of it.
So I can hear some sentences in Pritchard and Lowe.
Okay. I love sentences.
Okay. Okay, so things we would agree with. Redshifting with the cosmic expansion leads to a flow of photons from high to low frequency to fixed rate. As photons flow under the Lyman alpha resonance, they may scatter to larger or smaller frequencies. Since the cross-section is symmetric, you'd expect the net flow rate to be preserved. However, each time a Lyman alpha photon scatters from a hydrogen atom, it will lose a fraction of its energy due to the recoil of the atom. This loss of energy increases the flow to lower energy, leads to a deficit of photons close to line center. As this feature develops, scattering redistributes photons, leading to asymmetry about the line. This is exactly what's required for this to preferentially populate.
So this is for CMB photons?
So the line is shifted to the preferentially absorb the lower.
Yeah,
to the or the higher.
And this is for starlight photons, right?
Yes.
Yep. How does this relate to populating the spin levels at different ratios?
No, well, this is trying to.
I mean, I think the question is just if the spin up and spin down absorb in equal rates, because if they do, then I don't see what.
This is an attempt. I mean, this is related to their explanation of why. So they start this is starting the section of the Wuthausen field effect.
Yes.
And it starts out by it not at all being obvious why you would have any differential population of the singlet versus the triplet.
Mm-hmm.
And then, okay, this is all, they solve some equations and then have some words.
That's what I got. Like the P-wave state is also split. Oh. There's like four or whatever different orbitals, right? So,
yeah.
And then there are different selection rules. So I don't know if that can give rise to differential populations.
No, but these are nuclear spin flips. I don't think the photons care about those very much.
It's
the nuclear. The splitting? That's
yes. That's splitting is hard to find.
But it's on the scale of the 21 centimeter splitting also.
Is
the splitting due to misalignment of the proton spin and the hydrogen spin?
Yeah.
The
proton spin and the
electron spin. Yeah.
You said proton and hydrogen.
I don't have to. I mean, I can think about the proton spin being up, and that is up or down. The only choices that I have. I mean, it's just aligned or misaligned. So you don't just flip the spin. Okay.
This is Pritchard Loeb. This is 21 centimeter cosmology, 21st century, 1109-6012.
Here's a picture from Loeb, from the video.
Oh.
Do you see the grid?
See.
Oh, it's not there.
No.
my attempted explanation was just that this curvature really could be. Anything, but you'd expect the floor of it to be the cosmological AD values and the measure center.
And is that known very well? And it's known. So the line, the floor line.
Yeah.
That's known well.
That's not a technical term. Everything else I've said maybe actually is correct. I just said floor in my head and then just said it out loud. So.
Okay, sorry. The baryon.
That's fine.
Baryon line.
No, we use the floor.
That's there's no error on that.
So this is pretty well understood. I mean, so we know the distance scanning cross section. The only thing that there's maybe a tiny bit of error on is the ionization fraction, because you do need free electrons to catalyze that. But there's I think it's pretty well agreed upon what the right things. There's these Einstein coefficients and these collisional de-excitations and stuff. And so I think that those are pretty well measured. And there's a couple of different codes that do it with higher precision, I think they agree.
Presumably by the time you're going to these kind of zeds, you've got some level of structural major uncertainty.
Right, that's right. So that's why that's why you have to do many.
Yeah, but on the baryon kinetic temperatures, I think that's what was being asked about. What's the kinetic temperature of the other baryons, and there's some uncertainty on that as well.
Well, the floor.
Oh, you mean by the floor you mean to the lowest temperature they could have, not the temperature they actually have.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fine. Okay.
Yeah. So that's just set by adiabatic cooling, but that's determined by the decoupling of shift.
Fine. Yeah.
And so Tracy Slattier had a paper a day or two ago, which they they made the point that if you make this decoupling of shift 500, then you get a floor line that's down there.
Okay.
And so that would also, that'd be another explanation of somehow you could cook up physics that could Thompson's cutting stuff at 500 instead of 200.
Yeah, I think there's one paper having an anomalous expansion history. So if you have like early dark energy, you're speeding up the Hubble radar and you're making it a couple earlier.
Yeah.
And then the cooler variants.
And then this Falkowski paper and Gaia Petrachi, if you have like some new, like there's fewer electrons than there are protons in the universe, but the universe is charge neutral because there's a new null charge component that makes up for density, but it winds up not working. But I think that they were trying to do something similar.
Yeah, I think part of that paper doesn't survive. There's also, I think, a candidate with a very big charge and it's massive, and this stuff would show up in an anomalously heavy nuclei.
So I think it doesn't. I think it doesn't work. But I think that they were trying to say, okay, we have fewer electrons. We have the same amount of negatively charged stuff, but some of that negatively charged stuff doesn't see protons. Or doesn't see hydrogen, and so it can't catalyze this to stay in equilibrium. That's all I got for my prompt too.
Thank you. That's great. Thank you.
Like show and tell day. I think this is what I read in the last
2 days. Could you say the Oakley number again, if any?
Oh, sure. Sorry, let's go ahead. It is 1109.6012.
Thank you.
It's my homework or something like that. I mean, so okay. The curmudgeon in me says it's some systematic, but I mean, is that just curmudgeonly?
No, I mean the curmudgeon in you and the experimentalists that bring it up say that too. So.
Also at CETA. Also at CETA, the Toronto.
Yeah, it's just a really really hard thing to measure. I think. They need to. There will be another experiment called LEDA, LEDA, that is taking data.
Same redshift or some?
Also looking for the global 21 centimeters signal. I think it has a slightly smaller energy range that they look at, and since the foregrounds are so big. Yeah. So the foregrounds are really bright, and the issue is that you're trying to get this tiny signal out of that, and so it's easier if you have a like wide sideband. So the fact that they're looking at a smaller energy range means it's going to be tough.
What about antennas with spatial resolution, like interferometers?
Then you can presumably subtract the foregrounds better, right?
Yeah. And are you asking when will those be?
What's the status of those?
I mean, for sure the square kilometer array would be able to do that, but that for sure does not exist yet. Then who knows? So I don't know that.
So since the recording's off, it's a really stupid question. I mean, this is basically like a plate in the middle of the Australian desert, right? So why did it take so long for this measurement to be made?
I think they made the measurement relatively quickly, and then they spent a long time.
But you would think, measure 21 centimeter, we could put a 3 meter plate out. I mean,
you mean, yeah.
This would seem like a good idea to do as soon as you understood 21 centimeter.
It was very funny to see a Nature paper with like a steel grid spread on the ground.
Yeah. I mean, it is funny. Like that seems to be like the state of the art for this field. Like I looked up a LEDA paper yesterday, and they also have a picture of their apparatus. It's like I don't even see it. I believe that you have an apparatus. I'm not sure. I mean, I think maybe it was just this was like second order. It's just lower down the priority list of the cosmological people.
I mean, has it been a long time? Has it been known that there would be something at 21 centimeters? Is that obvious?
I think my impression was that the field was focusing on these angular variables more, and that's a more
challenging.
Because
of foreground information?
Yeah, and that's a more challenging. I mean, it's the same story. there's a big plan to do something complicated because foregrounds are difficult, right. And then so someone goes and does something quick and sees the signal.
Bicep thought they knew their foregrounds.
No, but people always said that you should look at least two frequencies to make sure.
Yeah. But they were working from some, you know, community consensus foreground map, which wound up being
inadequate. The community consensus was extracted from a talk.
Digitized
from a talk, which they didn't understand.
The bicep program?
Yes. It was from a plank slide.
It was from a plank slide, which they digitized.
Bloggers, digitization, error.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Well, there's nothing even like that here. I mean, like this is below that in sophistication.
And so here the four. I mean, it's literally like the sideband, and they're just doing a sideband subtraction. That's their foreground. I mean, what's their foreground estimate consist of here?
I think they fit into some power laws.
Yeah. It's just a volume.
But there are like radio interferometers right now, right? They're just at the wrong frequencies, like the VLBI radio interferometers. They have,
I don't think you need that good spatial resolution.
No, I know they have like close to microarc second, but so those are too high frequencies, I guess. They're at gigahertz. They can't sort of.
Maybe.
Yeah, I mean.
What does ALMA do? ALMA is like maybe that's millimeter actually.
Yeah, then maybe it's just I'm not sure. I mean. But I think they're pointing at such a tiny angle that they can't tell you. Mm. I mean, it's hard to do a diffuse measurement on something with that good of angular resolution, which is some combination. And maybe they choose that energy range because they have fewer foregrounds. Penzias and Wilson got the right temperature of the CME right away, but it's just because of the foregrounds here are far tougher.
Sorry, you probably already mentioned this, and I was just reading through looking at this Pritchard and Loeb thing, and I missed it. So the whole story so far, at least the anomalous explanations, is basically you relate the spin temperature to the baryon temperature, and then you explain why the baryons are colder. Is there any mechanism that just directly acts on the spin temperature?
Directly acts on the spin
temperature. I mean, if you came up with some physics phenomena my impression of how these stories mostly run is you either
it means you directly have to change the population.
Yeah, which sounds crazy, but I'm just trying to anatomize the places that you would put in.
So the
options are you cool the baryons, right? You change the number of photons, or as opposed to using the right hand side of that equation, you literally put in new physics that changes.
The spin. Preferentially down.
Exactly. That changes directly, as opposed to having to do with this history. Is that totally crazy? I mean,
you would need it.
Oh yeah.
I mean, so these are huge cross sections.
Sure.
So you would need it to have a strong velocity dependence. I guess you could need it. So if you have like a dipole interaction, then with a massless mediator, then that could be 1/q². Whatever you do the fourth, I'm not sure if that's enough to buy you the difference that you need. I don't know if anybody's actually looked at it seriously.
It feels crazy. I mean, but those are sort of the places you do. You cool the baryons, you change the photons, or you would
depopulate things instead of.
Yeah. So somehow something should couple to the total spin of the hydrogen atom, right? So that it sees the total spin one, but
you could just couple to the electrons.
You wouldn't want to do that. I mean, you wouldn't want to do that because you'd actually heat up the spin temperature.
Yeah.
You'd put more things than the.
Yeah, you
decalibrate that. Yeah. So, yeah, so you definitely have to have the whole spin.
Sounds crazy.
I mean, that's a good point, that it's not just a dipole.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder. I mean, this makes all the lead-up people probably tears their hair out, though. You know, like they, I'm sure they don't. They want to like
do a really good job now.
Yes.
Okay, how did you, this looks like under master vlogs, but.
What one did you say? Can you read it to me?
Oh, so the radio interformers is not the right thing to use to look at this.
There's another sentence of value. Radio interferometers are not the right thing to look at this.
What's
other
things?
Things like
edges. There's this low-power array that's, in, I think, in the Netherlands that is in the right frequency range.
It's all over Europe.
Oh, yeah. All over Europe?
All over Europe, yeah.
And that's an interferometer, so they have directional sensitivity, but why is an interferometer not good?
Yeah, I'm slightly
unclear what it means.
Yeah.
That low-power was, like, a broadband, or not to see it.
So yeah,
between 10 megahertz and 230.
Yeah,
so
sorry, that's what you said.
Yeah, so I thought they were here.
I mean, on Wikipedia, the 21 centimeter line is one of their science case bullet points, yeah. So presumably eventually it will be. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, people use it to mean things that different, like the 21 centimeter line at Z of 20 is assumed to be quite different from the 21 centimeter line at Z of 10, and to value totally different things. But
When you say this, the global, this is the Z of 17.
Oh, I mean,
like
global
doesn't necessarily
like that.
Sky
I just mean.
So we're here.
But the fact that they're seeing it at this at 73 megahertz or whatever is. That's telling you that it's Z of 17, and that's telling you that it's this the cosmic dawn thing. Whereas if you looked at it at Z of 10, then it would tell you about star formation.
Yeah, you're right, because on this bullet point, it's talking about Z between 6 and 10, so that might be a bit later. I'm not sure.
I mean, well, the claim there are various presentations which I don't quite understand, but the claim is interferometers are insensitive to a global signal, which is why they're the wrong thing to use for this. So.
But that doesn't mean they can't characterize the backgrounds.
Oh yeah, sure. They can do that. But they can do something along those lines. They can characterize the backgrounds spatially. I don't know.
Yeah, that's
just
from my book too.
Maybe they could look like identify a galaxy or something. Maybe if they have such good instrumentation. Mm-hmm. Like a super high dimension galaxy. Maybe that's what they're trying to do.
Should have had a radio astronomer come.
Yeah, it's very sensitive.
Small scale experiment.
Oh, this is small scale.
This is sensitivity for Kerrigan. This is like.
So obviously, you know, even if the curmudgeonly response is right, this is systematic, this is a sign that we're in the 21 centimeter era. So
yeah,
what other things should I care about? I mean, looking forward as a beyond the standard model theorist, what could I optimistically hope to get excited about from 21 centimeter measurements?
Where I've come to on that is that we have snapshots of the universe right now. We have like BBN and CMB, and this is going to tell us a lot about some broad range of redshifts, and so any kind of we're going to have to get a lot of astrophysics out of it before we get BSM out of it, I think, but at some point it should, you know, it's like CMB stage 4 or something where you're just going to have those. The difference in the amount of information we have is going to be enough that it's just of a different kind. So knowing that delta ineffective is less than 0.3 or less than 1 or something, that just, it's qualitatively different to know that it's less than 10 to the minus 4 or something, or 10 to the minus 3, which is what CMB stage 4 is hopefully.
Right, but I can translate it. What is the physics lesson I learned? Sort of any degree of freedom of thermal equilibrium with the standard model.
It grounds on
ionization
and decay.
So that kind of stuff, any kind of energy injection at all. But if you're saying, you have to deplete it this well at that point, like you need it to be this exponentially suppressed, it's already what we have is pretty good, but this is going to be quite different.
Any other topics of interest? Somebody must have some questions about dark matter detection or something. Something I'd like to ask.
What's after after molecules? Is there anything? Are there like synthetic molecules?
I'll be talking next week about other ways. Well, other probes of the same kind of frequency range which can go together with those kind of experiments.
I think the next thing is, so I think there are good ideas above 20 eV because, you know, you can ionize things. For example, the xenon ionization energy is above 12 eV, or at 12 eV. But going lower than 0.2 eV, so far infrared sort of quanta, are very difficult.
Sorry, where did the dark radio, where does that crap out? That's like...
So yeah, you can build an electronics up to about a terahertz, like hundreds of gigahertz has been demonstrated. But so hundreds of gigahertz is 10 to the minus 4 eV.
Yeah.
So from 10 to the minus 4 eV to 0.1 eV, there's not very good, you know, the reason why they don't work anymore is because, you know, you can't build cavities that small, or you could, but they have such a small volume that they're not very sensitive. So it's too high energy for that, but it's too low energy to do single quantum detection, so single photon detection.
And that is like the optimal range. I mean, that's part of the optimal range for whatever, you know, dark photon abundance from inflation.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And gives you the axion string production and
right. These
kind of
things. So it's a very interesting
part. Yeah. We've banged our heads against the wall, but nothing milli EV-ish came out. So
there's some potential with like bolometric detectors if you have big enough setups, but that remains to be seen.
Sorry, when you say big enough setup, I mean you're talking like the scale?
Large enough volume of target. So if you can have a large enough volume of target and focus things down to like kind of detectors they use for astronomy and those things, like these TESSs just run in thermometer mode effectively, so you're not looking for individual photons, just heating, then there's possibly useful range you can get to for, say, QCD axon type experiments, but that is, you'd need. That's hard. You need a big B field.
Sorry, what volumes are you? I mean,
big B field over sort of reasonable macroscopic-ish volume.
Reasonable macroscopic. Sorry, I mean, yeah, I think like okay, whatever. We have neutrinos double beta decay. We have.
Oh no, it's not talking about that.
No, but I'm understanding now. I appreciate it's not the same experiment. What I'm saying is that we have, you know, bolometer instrumented cold detectors on appreciable scales, and so I'm just trying to understand how radically crazy these requirements are relative to existing bolometer technology.
Or another way to say it is, can you repurpose just the fact that bolometers stay cold for, like, what range can you do just for right now?
I'll talk about this a bit next week.
Okay.
But sort of single photon detection, there are photon detectors now that have dark ant rates of one photon of, say, EV in energy per day. So that's in power flux, that's something like 10 to the minus 25 watts. So 10 to the minus 25 watts. So and bolometers are not...
Yeah, bolometers, you're looking at the noise equivalent power, about 10 to the minus 20 watt per root hertz.
Yeah.
So that's much, much worse than trying to look for single photons.
Thank you, that's perfect.
Yeah.
Right, so what's drawn on the board is actually one idea to go beyond it, but... So there are these. We tried to extend the molecule idea to lower energies, which is maybe I can draw it on the board. So there's these buffer gas cells used in the ACME experiment. Molecules tend to freeze right into solids as you go to lower temperatures, but the ACME experiment had basically some box. Called the buffer gas cell with a vapor pressure of helium, say at 1 Kelvin. So the boiling point is 4 Kelvin, but at 1 Kelvin there's significant vapor pressure still. So what you can do is have your buffer gas cell here with a small aperture, so you have helium escaping. What you can do is you can put in a little bit of solid molecule of interest, it's a solid at 1 Kelvin, and then you can shine a laser onto this, so you get ablation and you get your big molecule out. in the gas cell. So in the ACME experiments, they want to look for an electric dipole moment in thorium oxide. And so you shine a laser onto it, so it has energies of, say, 1,000 Kelvin once it's ablated, but then it collides with the helium hundreds of times, and then it cools down, and you get a flow of thorium oxide molecules out, essentially at 1 Kelvin. And they escape the buffer gas cell before they hit the wall or each other, so they don't freeze and become...
And the beam velocity is appropriate to 1 Kelvin?
Yeah, so 1 Kelvin thorium oxide means they come out at 100 meters per second. And it's essentially collisionless because it spreads out. It's essentially collisionless here. And, you know, they have some interaction region where they excite the thorium oxide and try to measure its electric dipole moment. But so 1 Kelvin is important because this is 10 to the minus 4 eV. Right, so the idea we had, and it's in progress and might not work at all, is that because this is below, you know, this is such a low energy, basically the excited states of these, it doesn't need to be thorium oxide, it could be something else. But the molecules here, they're rotational levels or their vibrational levels, which may be at milli EV or 10 to the minus 2 EV, they're completely empty. And you could even clean them. You could just pump them away, the few residuals that are out here. So, you know, if this is a meter-long interaction region, then you have 10 to the minus 2 seconds to absorb dark matter particles. And so we were thinking of some interaction scheme. Like the thing I talked about yesterday was...
So the idea is to get them in the ground state.
Yeah, so they're essentially all in the ground state. So this whole beam is completely in the ground state. You can arrange that relatively easily. And there are molecular transitions, like vibrational and rotational transitions, go all the way down to 10 to the minus 4 eV and below. It's just they're usually thermally occupied, right? So dark matter can excite to some excited state. The issue is if you want to do what I talked about yesterday, you have several problems. The decay back down would take way too long, plus the single photon that you would get out of here is too low energy to see. There's no good single photon detectors.
Well, you interrogate them coming out to see if they're in the excited state? Is that the...
Yes, no, so you would, so what we were thinking about was trying to pump them to some electronic state, call it 2, which has a much faster decay rate, right? So this would be dark matter, this would be some pump laser, and then your state 2 would have a relatively fast fluorescence rate, and then you try to detect, you try, so here would be your pump laser, and then you would try to, you would try to detect like the single photon emission in a small detection region. The issue is that
what's the flux of the
yeah laser? Good that is the issue. The flux that the ACME experiment has is 10 to the 10, but it's pretty easy to push it to 10 to the 12 molecules per second, and that, you know, compared to what I was talking about yesterday, which is like meter scale or 10 centimeter scale volumes, you know, you get Avogadro number, and this is not quite enough because the effective number of molecules you have is this 10 to the 12 times the, you know, times the time they can interact with dark matter. So your effective number of molecules is about 10 to the 10, and they might push this up because no one's tried to get huge fluxes, but it's hard. And yeah, if you increase you try to pump in some, you could have some feed line of, instead of doing this laser ablation method, you could have a feed line, but then things, ice builds up, and it's hard. So this is not quite, you're just signal limited. Even if you're signal limited, this is not quite
so enough. What was the temperature of the experiment you talked about yesterday?
100 to 300 Kelvin.
Oh, so I see. So not super cold.
So Dave Patterson is here now at UCSB. He was the molecular buffer gas guy for ACME. Would it be of any interest to have him give a talk?
Oh yeah, for sure.
I mean,
for sure.
Okay, tell us what he thinks the frontiers of, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
So at the fifth force limit, for example, or the equivalence principle limit, what is the rate of the excitation?
So with this low number of molecules, you're completely...
Let's look at one. Yeah, so do you know the excitation rate?
You mean for scalar absorption?
Yeah,
I mean, I can't do it off the top of my head, but so basically with this low number of molecules, we think you might have sensitivity to hidden photons because of the screening effects that people talked about yesterday. So there's this, if you remember, so in epsilon and mass, there's the stellar cooling limit I think it goes down a milli-EV.
It's 10 to minus 10 at a
milli-EV. Yeah, 10 to minus 10.
Yeah.
So it's 10 to minus 10 here, and then there's, so at milli-EV, and then...
Slope for minus 1.
Yeah, so this is m to the minus 1. And at 12 EV, there's this xenon dark matter surge, right? So this is xenon 10.
Sorry, what's the straight line?
Okay. And this is excluded from, this solar emission. There's two limits. There's a solar cooling limit, and then there's the sun emitting hidden photons that then would ionize xenon. And they're both comparable, roughly, within a factor of a few. So the reason why this, you know, I was showing, you know, sensitivity curves that went all the way to 10 to the minus 18 yesterday with a meter scale volume. But that was for, you know, many Avogadro number of molecules. If you go down from many Avogadro number of molecules to 10 to the 10, your sensitivity is down by a huge fraction. So we think with this method you might get sensitivity here. So maybe go down to 10 to the minus 12 or so. But the feature of hidden photon bounds getting weaker at lower masses is not a feature that scalars or pseudoscalars have. Like the coupling of the coupling constraint from stellar emission or supernova emission is flat, right, for an axion and for a scalar.
This has to be Stuckelberg bound, right?
It has to be Stuckelberg.
Yeah, otherwise it's like a middle charge non decoupled with mass.
So you might. I mean, and the question is, how low can you go if you optimize this for a dark matter surge instead of an EDM surge?
So there's a bunch of experiments on treptans. On treptans, and you could do manipulation of.
This number, but like in lattices, even in optical lattices.
Just a second, yes. Yeah. So if you follow this EDM business, you know that Eric Carnell had a result with a single line, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it is a competitive result. It's not as strong as thorium oxide, so it's all about numbers.
But that's different. Like Eric Carnell is doing a phase measurement, right? Like if we're talking about, I mean, maybe you can think of a phase measurement, but these are absorption measurement, and your rate scales linearly with the number of molecules. So I don't think with trapped ions you can beat. You can beat. This is signal limited, so I don't think you can beat that with fewer molecules.
How big is the buffer box? Like, can you multiplex this in a significant way?
It's just expensive because it needs to be in a dilution fridge. Yeah. I think it's already 10, but a few centimeters.
Okay, so you can put like a 1,000 of these together or something.
How much money are you going to do?
Make the LHC to
the... Yeah, we were playing around with some... This is very preliminary, but there are some synchrotrons, like if this is a tiny buffer gas cell, there are electric quadrupole, storage rings for neutral molecules. if they have the right, this is what I was saying yesterday, if they have the right polarizability alpha, you can trap them in the transverse direction. So if this is your beam of neutral molecules with, you know, the right sign polarizability going into the board, if you have rods, you know, positively charged here and negatively charged rods here, they're trapped in the transverse dimension, the molecules. And this trap depth can be of order of a few Kelvin. And so if you have a 1 Kelvin beam that comes out, then they can actually be trapped in the transverse dimension. And there was a Nature paper a few years ago that managed to, you know, inject them into a storage ring. So these are four rods sort of going around. So it's like a 1 Kelvin neutral LHC, and they can even make this pulsed by pulsing this ablation. So they have little wave packets and some optics that they have this 1 Kelvin wave packets going around.
So isn't the 1 Kelvin volume of like quora is like a cubic meter? I mean, it's a very,
sorry, of what?
Of quora. What's that? It's one of the neutrinos, double beta decay experiments. But it's, do you remember, Dave? The cold volume, the 1 Kelvin volume of quora was I think that's
a cubic meter. Magnitude, certainly.
Yeah, I think it's a cubic meter. So maybe, I mean, you know, that's achievable.
Tons of right?
Maybe that.
But they're looking for a sort of high energy events, right?
It's a question of can you put a box in a fridge at a, no, I'm not saying use quora, but I mean, it's just a question of, you know, if we can get significant improvements in our numbers by, you know, I don't know, scaling up.
Right, that's a solid,
that it's expensive because of fridge, well, you could, you know, it's probably easier to cool that volume.
Right, sure. I'm just saying it's already 10 centimeters, so scaling this up is not a
But a Kelvin's not a, that can be scaled arbitrarily. The whole LHC magnet is 2 Kelvin.
Oh, sure, but I mean, it's finite. So I'm just saying quora is something that's fundable off of the,
Is this, I assume this is really far from like a QCD axiom.
It's far, it's far. Right. Yes. I don't know exactly how far, but five orders of magnitude in coupling, depending rates, would be my guess.
Yeah, we'll talk a bit about trying to, we'll see about plots, but we'll talk a bit about trying to get to QCD axiom, this kind of regime, in next week.
And the stuff you talked about yesterday, you don't make it colder because you don't want the molecules to freeze on.
There's not that many molecules that have boiling. I mean, helium's the lowest one, right? And that's an atom, a noble gas. Yeah. I think it might be H2 as a lowest one, 20 Kelvin or so. That's the lowest. But most things freeze. And they still have significant vapor pressure. But not below 100 Kelvin. Even nitrogen, right, which is not a very chemically reactive thing, has a boiling point of 77.
So just pushing the same as the acidity. There is a semantic isolation. There are people. It's a technique to look at radicals because. If you put radicals in a gas, there's a problem that they react with each other very quickly. Right? And basically what people do, they grow crystals where these molecules are embedded in xenon or some other inert gas. So, and typically it's about one molecule per 10 atoms in that, and spectroscopy is done there. You could even look at optical transitions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it might be, so, and then you also, you could imagine, so a typical sample is like a tablet, like a small pill, So it's not as huge as the volume that you have discussed yesterday. But still, you get an Avogadro.
Yeah, the question is just of reading it out, right? Reading out a single milli EV absorption quantum. If the QCD axion was a milli EV, it would just get absorbed in your body all the time at relatively high rates. The question is just reading it out. It's a tough part.
So on the detection side, I think people are trying to push superconducting detectors down to lower thresholds, and at least for things like the MKIDs, I don't think there are theoretical reasons why you couldn't push them down to near milli EV, but they're a long way from that right now. So we'll see how that improves.
Is that a fabrication issue, or is that a... What are the issues with it?
So from trying to talk to experiments, I'm not sure they know exactly what's causing all the noise they have in these things.
No, in fact, Benazine jokes that it is detection of dark matter.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, exactly. So they don't know what's causing the noise.
Are they gonna calibrate it away?
Ben's gonna talk about his conference. We want to have Ben, and we can also have him come by next week.
Yeah.
Are there similar issues with transition edge sensors?
Yeah.
So, well, there you can work out what your sensitivity is limited by. You get to the right order of magnitude in principle, like how well you could do. And that's basically you want to make a very small test with a very weak thermal conductance between that and a very cold buff. And the further you can push all of those things, the better you can theoretically do. So again,
basically you're limited. Your energy resolution is limited by the heat capacitance of your little thing. So if you make it smaller and smaller, then it helps. But then also you start getting other noise issues when you try to couple this tiny thing to.
Yeah. Apparently, Matt Pyle was trying to do single photon detection at very low energies, and he's sort of abandoned the idea for now because he has that excess noise as well.
So it depends on who you ask.
Yes,
that's
that.
Whether he's abandoning
it. Yeah,
it's not who says that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, people are saying that he's pushing it to like 30 milli EV.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
That's a lot of papers.
But yeah, I mean, I don't think it's been.
Yeah, sure. They were way off that right now.
Because, like, I guess the 50 by 50 micron is sort of getting towards 100 milli EV, like energy resolution. And you need to go a few factors of the energy resolution above that to get really single photon detection. So you need really tiny things.
Very tiny things, very weak couplings.
Yeah,
that's the other argument, right? The TESs, they're more sensitive the smaller they are, but that can be incompatible with a large number of molecules or large absorption targets. Around a milli EV, it's unfavorable scaling.
But they can't do something like put those perfect mirrors around it.
That is what Manuel was suggesting in one of those papers, right?
Just have some bigger groups in some kind of possible like,
So the bigger your collection fin is, the smaller the temperature increases as you absorb one fixed quantum of energy. Right.
You need to have a very, very high quality factor so it bounces around many, many times effectively.
And that's one thing you can optimize, right? You can optimize the cost of possible lifetime and then have a very, very small connection.
You can try it,
And it needs to not get reabsorbed, I guess, inside whatever you're bumping around.
On
the way up from microwave frequencies, they're starting to be able to do single photon detection there now as well. So using these microwave quantum non-demolition techniques. So they're pushing up from microwave and down from sort of optical, but there's still this sort of terahertz gap in the middle where things are difficult.
Where is Sensei?
Sensei is below D9.
Yeah, the band gap of silicon is 1.1 EV, so definitely not below there.
The sensor got 3 EV up as well?
They're sensitive to 2 electron excitations, and so the gap to excite 2 quasi-particles is 3.4.
So they actually have new results. Absorption plot, I asked Ruben, and they don't.
Oh, they don't beat the
stellar bands? Well, he didn't even have the stellar bands on his plot, but he had the Dammit bands, so they don't beat those. But for scattering, they do a bit better. So this is just a 0.02 gram day run on the surface. Yeah, so it's really cool.
But so they were all scaled up to be.
Yeah.
So I mean, we also at UCSB, although I embarrassingly know almost nothing about it, we have the Institute for Terahertz Science and Technology.
There we go.
We get Mark Sherman to come tell us about what they can do in terahertz.
That would be interesting.
Yeah, that would be very interesting.
Yeah, because it's
right. Good job, Mark. I'm sure he'd be glad to come talk to us. And give us a tour. That's the building. If you head towards where that is, like a blocky, windowless building.
That's right. Sounds ominous.
He'd love to come in here for a little bit of light. And
okay, cool.
So I wanted to ask a question about, you know, we say all the time, like, you know, very light photon dark matter, and the production mechanism is like these inflationary perturbations by Peter and Sugi.
Mm-hmm.
So can someone explain, like, this very easily, why the freezing doesn't work, like, for instance? I mean, I understand why you cannot do freeze out, but...
Coupling bumps.
So there's a line for freezing.
Yeah.
It's just kind of, just somewhat high. I mean, it's not, you can't fill the space with it. There's just some line for freezing.
So you're saying the line is already excluded?
I'm not sure if it's excluded. I think it's just a one. It's a one piece.
Okay, so I just don't know where.
That's the line on it.
Sorry, the free that's if you have merely charged stuff, or if you just have a dark photon.
I think
if
you just.
So
have
one's different dark photon.
Yeah, that's what I think.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure what.
I think just.
Yeah, because there's a line here, so. Sorry, people can't see this. So I don't know why it's cutting off there, though. So this red line is basically freezing. Or freeze out, I'm not sure which.
Well, that
kind of
makes a big difference.
Yeah.
That should be
freeze
out, right?
That's presumably
freeze
out.
No, that's not that, though. Oh, that's a CMD bond.
Alright, I nominate one of you to draw this
one.
Okay, we don't want to.
So this is a bad idea.
We need to more research is needed.
I think
it is freeze, and I'm not sure if they always refer to it that way.
Okay,
it's been done before.
I mean, let's put it this way.
So it's the scattering off of electrons, or?
I think most of it in that mass range comes from resonance production. So it's like you can think about it. Like you don't need to know the left-hand side of the diagram. It's just a charged particle emitting one of these.
Oh.
It's up shell, but it doesn't matter.
What epsilon is it for? I mean, I've only seen the line drawn for MeV-ish hidden photons, and I thought it was like epsilon is 10^-6, 10^-5.
Yeah, and then when you go below 2 ME, then it's relatively flat.
Yeah. And you were talking about way lower.
Yeah.
Way lower,
yeah, so I think this is just from memory, but if this is the mass of the dark photon, and this is 2 ME,
what?
It's some mass.
Left hand mass.
Okay. 2 ME.
Okay.
This is like 10^-5, and then it drops down to like 10^-9, and it's. It's got some shape and it rises slightly, but it's less than here. I don't know how.
Yeah, it's all excluded.
Okay.
So this is pretty deeply inside. So. And it's just along that line.
This doesn't match up quite with this, but I don't know what you think, mean. So.
Is that the fixing line?
Can I miss
this one?
Sure. So,
what? Is the drawing the fixing line?
Yeah, I think. Okay. I mean, it's from production, just from charged particles. So.
I'm confused because if I look at those two plots, your line is obviously above that line, right?
Yeah, I think that's a statement. That
the
freezing line is already excluded, so we don't have any.
Strong enough couplings would have been seen in stars.
Sure, but what I mean is, you know, the line he's drawn is above the line in the plot that can just draw, right?
Yeah, which means it's excluded.
So the freezing.
Oh, I see. Okay, fine. Okay.
It's probably not good.
So there might be like a small population, freezing population below the solar cooling band.
Yeah, okay. It's with your environment.
We should make sure how it actually goes down to those masses.
There certainly is a scaling of mass. It's not steep, but it may
persist. Because there's a little hole between the solar bands and then the CMB, so.
I mean, most likely it scales as the inverse.
Yeah, I mean, it should decouple.
It has to decouple. It's from early in the universe production. Just by plasma frequency.
Yeah, but you're always getting that plasma frequency at some point.
Oh yeah, but then you have so you have the usual thing of a steep feature. Once the electron positron freeze out happens, then the plasma frequency goes down very steeply. Then it's more even, and yeah, so there'll be some steep decoupling there. There'll be features.
I think that's.
But it'll all be fairly deeply excluded, I guess.
Right.
For these ultralight dark matter things, other than the axion, are there any sort of favorite regions of parameter space? I know it's like you can't do the same sort of precise calculation, more or less, like this is the line I really want to get to. Is there anything like that? Like string model A predicts discoupling from isolatons, or something? I don't know.
Yes, there are predictions for that. Depending on which string model A3Z, I think you can get a wide range. For example, for direct photon, you can get, you usually have a loop mixing, and then you can have some splitting between your states that are charged under this direct photon, and that can give you a small epsilon.
There's no preferred epsilon.
Yeah, there's no preferred value for that.
Totally unrelated to the how you get it.
Yeah.
And it's a massive particle, so there's no like weak gravity conjecture about bottom of the floor, right?
Yeah.
Not my pick.
You
might hallucinate that, gravity is different at a million EV, so it would be cool if you could detect scalars with gravitational strength at a million EV. We're far from that. You'd need more than a Avogadro number of molecules to do that, or whatever